Bueno, pues más allá de la una de la mañana, después de cierto realmente agotador y que yo creo que todos hemos disfrutado y vamos a intentar transmitir en la medida de lo posible, pues en esta conversación con voz de cansancio y con músico cansado. Ken van der Mark, que visitaba por primera vez España, lo hacía el pasado sábado en Huesca y el pasado domingo en Barcelona. Ken, your first time in Spain, welcome. At last, you are in Spain.
Well, thank you very much. We had a great time tonight. This is fantastic.
Bueno, yo la primera idea que me gustaría transmitirle es saber cómo siente un músico, de qué manera siente un músico como Ken van der Mark venir a un país tan lejano como es España para él, que vive en la ciudad de Chicago, y encontrarse con tanta y tanta gente que ha madrugado, incluso se ha levantado a las 7 de la mañana para verle, e incluso encontrarse con un aficionado que tiene una página web dedicada en castellano a él.
How do you feel as a musician from Chicago who come to a place like Huesca, so far away from your town, and when you find people from everywhere in Spain, and even a fan who has a internet web page dedicated to you?
Oh wow! It's kind of overwhelming in a way because. You know, we've been traveling a lot and doing a lot of touring with the musicians I play with from Chicago and in Europe and other places in the United States, especially for the last few years, last 3 years. And it feels like each time we come back, like coming to Spain now, to have so many people who know the music that we've done and have a lot of the recordings and are familiar with the things that we're doing. For me, I find it really overwhelming that so many people have such interest in what we've been doing in Chicago for a long time, and the music we've been working on with other people outside of Chicago. It's really gratifying because, you know, we get to work a lot at home, and when we leave and we find that the music that we play communicates to people outside of that city, it means a lot. It's kind of taking it out on the road to test it in a way to see if it has relevance outside of our own place that we work. So to be able to tour like this and play to people in a country I've never been to in front of an audience that's never seen us play live and have such a great response is really meaningful for me.
Do you know more people like Patxi Tapiz that has a Ken van der Mark web page in the world?
I don't look at the internet too much because it's probably better if I don't know those things.
Bueno, Ken van der Mark es uno, para los aficionados quizá que más profundizan en la creatividad, en el jazz, uno de los músicos más creativos e innovadores, pero quizá no lo suficientemente conocido tanto por el aficionado medio al jazz como incluso por otros músicos. ¿Cuáles pueden ser las razones, según el propio Ken van der Mark, de que eso sea así? No sé si es una cuestión del sello discográfico en el que grabe, de la ciudad en la que él desarrolla su carrera en comparación con otras ciudades quizá más famosas en cuanto al jazz en Estados Unidos, un poco esa idea.
Okay, you are one of the most important musicians, jazz musicians right now, most creative in the jazz scene today, but you're not very known outside your town and by the middle jazz mm-hmm. fan mm-hmm. and by a lot of musicians. What's your opinion about that?
The reason.
What's the reason for that?
Yeah, because maybe you are recording for small labels, or you come from a town like Chicago, which is not New York.
Right, right. I think the reason, there's probably a lot of different reasons. I think the two reasons you cited are pretty significant as far as that goes, because all the labels I do work with are small independent labels, most of them centered in the United States, and they don't have very good distribution in Europe. It's difficult to get the records. Although with the internet, that's changing because a lot of people can go directly to the labels and order them from the labels, so that's helped for people like ourselves, you know, like Kent and myself and other people I work with, get the records out. And also, for historically, New York has always been the center of the music, especially in the United States, but also internationally. It's been considered as the capital of jazz. And I think, personally, and this is not to slight the musicians in New York, but I think that, especially in the last 30 years, there's been a real shift to the most creative music happening in jazz or improvised music, however you want to call it. It shifted internationally much, much more. I mean, all the developments that happened in England in the late 60s, early 70s with people like Derek Bailey, Evan Parker, or Paul Litton, who played tonight, Tony Oxley, the Dutch guys like Misha Mengelberg, Han Bennink, the German musicians like Peter Koval, Peter Brutzmann, and on and on. I mean, they really have been developing music that's very, has connections to American jazz, but also stands apart from it, that has an immense amount of creativity and historical significance. And that's true with Chicago, too. I mean, the AACM was developed in the mid-60s and really got, I think, stronger in terms of its concepts and whatnot in the later 60s. And that was really apart from what was happening in New York. So all the work of the early art ensemble, Mulhall, Richard Abrams, all that stuff. And that was centered in Chicago. So there was already a lot of things happening away from New York that had their own history and their own sensibility. So in the mainstream jazz media, though, New York is still talked about and considered as the main place. And I'm not really interested in their perspective, to be blunt about it. I think that they hold on to a history that creatively has kind of reached its end point. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a lot of creative music happening in jazz, if you want to use that term, or improvised music, if you want to use that term, or whatever term. There's a lot of creative players doing incredible work right now. A lot of them don't get talked about in the mainstream jazz press in the United States, and my impression is that in Europe, that's true too. A lot of festivals are devoted to players that are working off of stuff that's kind of reached its zenith in creativity, I would say, many decades ago, from my own standpoint. And, you know, obviously there are a lot of people who disagree with me. But if you work outside of that jazz mainstream, they're not going to talk about you, you know. And that's fine with me, because I think that I'm more interested, and I think the people I work with are a lot more interested in doing creative work. And we're improvisers, and we work with people who are improvisers and who are trying to find their own voice and try to find their own ideas and develop those things. And we're not really concerned with the past. We're affected by it, and we're curious about it, and we study it, but we're trying to find our own thing to say. And I think that's the history of jazz that I personally feel really connected to, is the history of individuals making personal statements in their own time period, as opposed to, like, people trying to play Dixieland in the 50s, you know, when it was developed in the 20s, let's say, you know. And I think that that's going on now, frankly, with musicians, let's say, at the Lincoln Center, trying to work on the music of Duke Ellington, for example. When Duke Ellington played that music better than anybody's going to play it, you know. And so why not? Yeah, right, exactly. There's the records. I mean, it's the evidence is there, you know. And so from my own standpoint, I think it makes more sense to, I feel tied to the tradition of personality, and I'm trying to figure that out for myself, and I don't want to sound like somebody else, you know, even if I'm influenced by them and have been impacted by them. So the fact that, you know, we get overlooked, I don't really care, you know. I think that, I mean, we're doing something right if we can come here on a night like this and play to so many people and play the music we care about. Obviously, someone's finding out about it, and the right people are finding out about it, you know. So as long as I think we can stay committed to what we're doing and keep focused on trying to be creative musicians, which is our job, I think, you know, we'll be fine. We don't need to have front cover photographs on mainstream jazz magazines, because we're not part of that, you know. We're a part of it, and I think we should be, in a way. We're connected to a history that they don't even really write about. I mean, if you, United States and a lot of public radio stations, for example, in Chicago, the public radio station there that plays jazz 40 hours a week, they don't even play John Coltrane and Thelonious Monk and Charlie Parker. They play, like, contemporary people doing pale versions of that music. And it's like, well, screw that. You know, I'm not part of that. I'm part, to me, if I can be so bold, I'd say I'm connected to the work of Thelonious Monk. I'm not saying I'm on the level of him, but his spirit and his creativity and his individuality, that's what I'm connected to. Not people that are trying to do bad versions of Round Midnight in 1999 or in 2003 now. You know, I'm not connected to them at all, you know.
Yo creo que esta respuesta de Ken van der Mar viene también a responder la siguiente pregunta, que es que siendo un músico de Boston, vos no ha pasado como, bueno, pues podíamos pensar por la Universidad de Berkeley. Imagino que las mismas razones que nos ha dado para explicarnos el por qué no es conocido entre el aficionado al medio, incluso los propios músicos, viene un poco también por esa filosofía, ¿no? De la manera de entender el jazz, no basado tanto en la tradición, sino en la creatividad y en la búsqueda de una propia voz. No sé si esa puede ser su opinión sobre Berklee. ¿Por qué no ha pasado por Berklee de alguna manera?
Yeah, maybe the reason you're not following the mainstream path can be linked by the fact that you're from Boston, but you haven't studied in Berklee. And
that certainly didn't hurt me. That's for sure, not to study that. Yeah.
And what's your opinion about those jazz schools and like Berklee or Juilliard?
Well, I mean, for me personally, I think it was really good that I didn't go to music school. I was lucky enough to be exposed to a lot of music as a kid growing up in the family I was in. And that was kind of my school in a way. And in general, I'm self-taught. And in general, a lot of the people I play with are self-taught in the best way, that they've tried to find the way to get to what they were hearing in their heads on their own terms, you know. And so they tend to be people who have a lot of individuality in their playing. I find that, I can't speak for the schools in Europe, but the schools that I'm aware of in the United States that I've been exposed to and that I'm aware of, the way that they teach is problematic because they erase the individual in the process of teaching them techniques. And technical ability to me is pointless unless it serves an idea, which means you have to have the ideas directing the development of the techniques. You can't sit in a room and say, well, gee, you know, I need to do this thing without having a purpose behind it. Because otherwise you have a bunch of tricks you can do that are empty and have no kind of, to me, any kind of real meaning. And I think that that a lot of those schools, they teach these correct ways of playing and they teach these skills without developing the creative aspect of the people who are going there. And I think a lot of people who go to music schools are creative people, you know, and the process of being there for, let's say, 4 years and competing constantly with other musicians who are all being told the same things, who are all being told this is the correct way to do this, this is the correct way to play a blues, or this is the correct way to play these chord changes. I mean, all that's extremely problematic. And I had Kent and I had a really funny experience when we did a workshop at a music college at a university, and we was with the Vandermark Five, and we did a course, a master class, so to speak, with the music students. And basically we showed them how we worked on some of our music in the band, and then we opened it up to questions. And there were a lot of interesting questions from the students, and that was cool. But at the end, the teacher said, well, you know, before we finish, I'd really like to find out what the five of you, you know, what your interaction with music school has been, which was like the worst question he could have asked, because it's like, I never went to music school, you know, and Kent dropped out and everybody else had dropped out and then they had gone on to study something else. So the people that had been brought to the school to you know, indicate other ideas in music to these students were basically told them, well, we all failed as music students.
You don't have the paper, you are a musician.
Yeah, that's a crazy idea. I mean, you're a musician or you're not a musician. Having a degree maybe enables you to have a chance to teach as a qualified instructor, but since I'm not interested in that anyway, I think there's more damage done in those situations than help done, because they don't focus on the potential of creative thinking. They just teach skills, because those are things that they can qualify. Like, you can or cannot play a certain series of scales, or you can or cannot play what they, you know. But if your ideas are contrary to public opinion, then what do? Are they going to fail you? Or are they going to, you know, because anyone who's doing something creative is going to be personal, will probably be outside of the boundary lines of what is correct, you know.
People are actually hearing stuff.
I'm sorry?
Kids out of hearing stuff.
Well, that's the thing. Exactly. What Ken's saying is that, you know, they go into school open-minded and wanting to play and excited, and a lot of them leave being embittered and not interested in playing, and it kills their thinking.
Instead of hearing real music and finding older musicians to play with who can show them things,
yeah,
all they have is school. They don't have, like, you know, it used to be you went and played with older musicians and you know, you learned from them and they showed you and gave you ideas and in a school that doesn't happen, you know.
Una de las cuestiones que más llama la atención de Kan van der Mark a los profanos de su carrera es la cantidad de discos que edita por año, de discos y cantidad también de grupos. Yo no sé, en el caso de los discos, con qué intención graba Kan van der Mark, porque imagino que no es la fuente de ingresos fundamental. Entonces, ¿cuáles son las motivaciones a la hora de realizar un disco de Kan van der Mark?
The jazz fan who's not who doesn't know very well who you are, mm-hmm. or your work, is surprised, normally surprised, because you're recording so much records and you have so many different projects and groups. And what are you trying to do? What's your goal?
What am I trying? I have no idea what I'm trying to do.
I imagine the city is not your way of life.
No, exactly. I mean, a lot of people have asked this, and a lot of people seem dissatisfied in my response to the question, but to me, the whole thing is playing live, and that the music is a process art form, which means that there may be goals that you have, but to me, it all happens in performance on the bandstand, playing with musicians night to night, you know. That's why I like touring, that's why I like playing a lot of concerts. And a lot of the groups that I play with, I think I would like to document the work that we are struggling with. So the recordings are kind of documents of a point in time with the material that those bands worked with. So in the case of the Van der Mark 5, I think it's our sixth record that's coming out. Well, that band's been together for 6 years. So that's one group out of, let's say, 10 or 12 or however many that I'm involved in pretty regularly. You know, to me, to document that particular group year to year is to show a timeline, an indication of how the ideas shifted in the band. It's a worthwhile set of indicators. But that's just one small part of what that band has done. You know, we've played, I don't know how many, 100 whatever concerts over the course of that time. And those are that's the real work, you know. So to me, the criticism of you putting out too many records, you know, well, okay, don't buy them. I mean, you know, but it would be also to me to say, well, then I'm playing too many concerts, you know, because the records are just one small part of the process that I'm involved in. And I think it warrants documentation. And people may disagree, and that's totally fair, but if people are curious about why there's so many records, I play in a lot of different groups, and those groups are constantly evolving and developing and changing. And I think having a record of what we did at that point in time is worthwhile. So.
Suele pasar a los músicos norteamericanos que visitan España, fundamentalmente en festivales de verano, no solo España, sino Europa, que desconocen absolutamente lo que se está haciendo en este continente en lo que a música creativa se refiere. Tu caso es diferente, sueles participar con músicos europeos, como el caso, por ejemplo, de Mats Gustafsson. No sé si aprecias algún tipo de sensibilidad diferente por parte de los músicos europeos en la manera de entender la improvisación con respecto a los americanos.
Most of the American jazzmen who come to Europe don't know the European scene, don't know the European musicians, but that's not your. You are very aware, very well aware of European musicians, and you play with mm-hmm. a lot of them. What do you think is the difference, main difference between European jazzmen and
the way of understand way to play?
Well, I think in a huge generalization, there are differences between the way American players tend to play as opposed to European players. But I think that those generalizations are really problematic because right now I think it's a lot more about the way certain individuals play. You know, that like I heard you mention Mats Gustafsson, for example. Okay, well, Mats is part of the Swedish scene. He's a very important part of that scene. But he doesn't represent the way that whole scene works. You know, I mean, if you look at Sten Sandell and Raymond Strid and the work that the three of them did in the group Gush, Yeah, that seemed like, oh, that was a Swedish way of playing free improvisation. But if you listen to those guys work outside of that group and work with different musicians that are also playing free improvised music in Stockholm and in Sweden, yeah, there's certain relationships there, but the way Mats plays is the way Mats plays. You know what I mean? And I think that's true in the United States, too. I mean, you could say, okay, Americans tend to be more interested in groove-oriented playing, like stuff with a beat and this and that. But then if you look at the work of, like, Joe Maneri or his son Matt Maneri, I would say, well, yeah, they're interested in that, but in a much more abstracted, opaque way than, let's say, me, when I play that kind of stuff with a beat, you know. They strip it out and move it around more. So I think that there are differences, but I think from my personal standpoint now, the reason I play with European musicians and American musicians is not so much like I'm seeking to bridge the gap between these cultures or anything, because even within Europe you have so many different cultural differences from country to country in the way that musicians play. And then within the countries they play differently. It's more about individuals who are interested to work with. And so whether they're in Chicago or they're in New York or Stockholm or, you know, wherever they are, it doesn't matter to me. It's more the issues of geographical distance have shrunk more and more. So it used to be, you know, you'd play with people who lived in your city. Well, now, you know, you play with people who live in your country or you play with people who live on the other side of the water. It doesn't matter so much. It's more about finding the right people who can communicate with you. And, you know, it costs some money to fly to Oslo, but who cares, man? It's like if you have people there that are worth playing, then let's go and let's play. Let's do the music. And so I think that the people that I tend to play with are people who have a similar viewpoint. It's not like, oh, I want to play with Ken because he's an American. They don't give a shit about that, you know. And frankly, it's probably in despite of the fact that I'm American. So, you know, I think that it's more a bunch of people in the world now around, you know, let's say middle 40s to middle 20s. I sort of see that group of people being very open to playing together, aren't so concerned about, well, is it free improvised music, or are you playing tunes, or are you playing with a beat, or are you playing melody? They want to just play music. And they're not so consumed by this issue of, like, is it jazz or not? I think they're a lot more interested in integrating musical elements that are outside of jazz that just interest them. You know, and so, like, if you look at, like, for me, example, like, with different projects I do, each of the projects has different elements that are musically interesting to me, and most of them include elements that are outside of strict the jazz history, you know. And I think that's much, much, much more common now than it was, let's say, 20 years ago, or 30 years ago especially, where people were making dividing lines, like, this is what we're doing. Like, for example, like the English guys being so severely breaking away from the American tradition to define their own personality. And they made this huge break and amazing innovative developments. Though that kind of thing isn't as common right now because people are kind of integrating all these ideas and finding ways for them to work together as opposed to finding their own special space, you know.
The two last questions because you have to rest. bueno, aquí tienes a muchos fans que quieren saber sobre tus próximos proyectos. Y alguno me ha dicho por ahí que hay una posibilidad de un proyecto de saxo solo. You have here a lot of fans that want to know your next projects. Someone has said to me that you are going to record a solo saxo.
Oh, yeah. That record got recorded in August, and it should be coming out hopefully by the end of April on Oka Disc. And that's the first solo record I've done, and I was trying to struggle with the idea of doing that for a long, long time, and I think I found some ways that for me personally hopefully sound like me and hopefully don't sound like me trying to play like Evan Parker, for example, or Anthony Braxton, for example, or Peter Broetzman, or Mats Kustason. You know, it's hopefully a personal take on solo reed music. So that's a new thing, but I mean, I'd be interested in doing more solo concerts. I've only done that in Chicago, and it's very sporadic. But to be frank, I'm much more interested in working with other musicians and collaborating with them, either, you know, in a small group or whatever, a large group. So I'll be focusing more still on doing that. And there's, in terms of new things, there's a trio with Paul Nelson Love and Nate McBride that I hope I'll be able to do more work with when Paul is better. And that's a new thing. And And then I'm going to try to sustain a lot of, you know, the groups like the Territory Band and then the Vandermark Five, and hopefully DKV will be able to do more stuff in Spaceways and School Day. I mean, there's a lot of groups that have been going on in the Brotzman Tentet, Chicago Tentet. My hope is to be able to sustain the most viable groups in terms of their creativity. Like the Vandermark Five, for me, has been a very viable group. You know, we've been together for a long time. There's been very little personnel change. And from my standpoint, the band keeps changing and developing because of the individuals in the group and my own ideas shifting and changing. And I would like to continue that group for as long as possible because it's an amazing marking point for my own ideas, and I think also the people in the band's development as well. And as long as that's possible, I'd like to sustain those groups. That being said, I'd like to be able to also work on new projects. I'd like to be able to do more work with Paul Litton and Paul Lovens, and then, you know, other musicians as well. There's a trio with Ingebrigt Holkerflaten and Håvard Vik, two Oslo musicians, and with me just playing clarinet and bass clarinet, piano and bass. So it's a very acoustic sounding group, somewhat related to the work of the Jimmy Giuffre Trio. And I'd like to do more with that group. So I'd like...
With Blay
and Swallow. Yeah, it's loosely connected to that. And so I'd like to keep sustaining the things that are really interesting and hopefully have them continue to grow and then integrate newer things in there too to keep my head, you know, unstable.
Solo before you will do totally improvisations or some compositions. Or
the solo music, it's kind of like using templates. It's material, but they're not strict compositions. Like this is the way the melody line goes, or this. It's more character studies, like sonic character studies. So on the record, what I've done is I've put, I think there's 13 pieces that ended up on the record. And then there's about another five. Like I did 13, I recorded it at home in the living room because it has good acoustics. And then with Malachi Richter, who does a lot of stuff in Chicago, records a lot of things. And then I did a live concert between the 2 days that I recorded at home. And I want to put five versions of these same pieces in the live context to hopefully show what I mean about them having a specific character but also being extremely fluid in the way that I can interpret them. So issues of like the way the acoustics in the room sound or the way I feel that day and all these things can really affect the way the music gets played. So thematically, like some of the tunes have melodic material, but the melodic material isn't written down. It's more a reinterpretation of a character or a feeling, you know. So it has specific material, but it's extremely fluid in the way that I interpret it, which has been successful for me in dealing with the issue of trying to do solo music. Because with solo, I mean, the thing with solo is there's nothing to it's you're working off yourself. So I was trying to come up with a way to work off of the acoustics in the room and a specific idea so it wasn't so strict, you know, of like, it has to sound this way. You know, because in general, it's when I'm playing with musicians, I can work off of them. Like tonight with Kent and Paul, it's like if I'm struggling, I can lean on them to help me get out of a problem or give me a solution to a problem. When you're playing solo, you have no one else to look to, and that's the real struggle of it, you know. So.
Dicen que la música es un lenguaje internacional, quizá, y más ahora que nunca, algunos debieran escuchar más música. The music is an international language. Maybe some people have to listen more music now, in this special moment.
Well, things are so screwed up right now that I think any time there's something that provides a respite from that or a chance to pull yourself out of that for just a minute or to give you some optimism about the human race, to be blunt about it too, is a really positive and a necessary thing. It's a really dark time right now, and hopefully the United States will slow down and not jump into some real huge mistakes. So I feel that the arts are, you know, music and other art forms are really crucial right now because I know that those are the things I lean on to keep me hopeful about people, you know, because so many things are so sad and screwed up that, you know, these kinds of things, we need optimism right now. And so if music is something that allows people to find that in this period, then I'm very proud to be trying to do that because hopefully we're contributing instead of doing something negative. And right now we don't need anything else negative, you know.
They have a radio program called Impro Jazz. Mm. You have to say, hello, I come under man, and you are listening Impro Jazz.
Okay. Hello, I'm Ken Vandermark, and you're listening to Impro Jazz.
Mr. Ken, thank you very much, and you have to rest. Thank you.
No, I don't have to rest. I have to get a beer.